Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations standpoint. This is Danny Tears Johnson.
Yama yama, hello on your beautiful Black Friday. My name's Danny Tears Johnson and welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to start the show by acknowledging country, and I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners from the lands that we broadcast from, and I'd like to pay my respects to the elders past and present, and I extend that to all across these beautiful black lands, to wherever you're listening today, your elders past and present. Today on Let's Talk, I'm very excited about today, we're yarning to the Legal Eagles from Parallax Legal, Steph Parkin and Cassie Lang. They are a law firm. They are a law firm that understands the importance of collective success. Like a legal compass, they navigate and mitigate risks within the areas of native title, cultural heritage, governance, intellectual property, Indigenous cultural rights and engagement. A lot of work. If that's what you're looking for, then you've come to the right place. Sisters, welcome to the show. Can you please start by introducing yourselves, your mob and your country?
Thank you. Thanks, Danny. Great to be here. Hello to everyone listening. Yes, my name's Steph Parkin. I belong to the Quandamooka people of North Stradbroke Island, connected to a lot of our mob over there. My lines are the Delaney lines and Martin lines. Grandma Bethel Martin and Pop Barney Delaney, and my mother is Evelyn Parkin and my father is Alan Parkin. So all my family continue to live on Minjeriba, my brothers and sisters and parents. So that's my country over there, and big shout out to them if they're all listening, that is.
Oh, they listen in AAA, of course. Hey? Murray Country.
Yes.
And what about you, Cassie?
So morning, everyone. My name's Cassie Lang. I'm a Minjibal woman from Bundjalung Country, northern New South Wales. Also related to the Curry families in southwestern Queensland.
Yep.
So being a native title lawyer, I find relatives pretty much everywhere I go, because I'm also related to the Williams and the Appos. So
yeah, right, big mix.
Big mix.
Yeah.
So find family pretty much most places in Queensland and northern New South
Wales.
It's
one of the great things about being a black fella, isn't it? You find family everywhere you go.
That's it.
Hey? Ladies, tell us about Parallax Legal. Tell us about the meaning of parallax by itself, but how you all come together. I haven't heard of the word parallax before. And I love first. I didn't know what it means. And then when I looked on your website and I saw the meaning, I thought, oh, that's really cool. But tell us about your legal profession, how you've come up with the name, and a bit about what you do.
Well, look, the name, Danny, it's a very new name to us as well. But when we actually found out about the definition, we thought, wow, that suits us and the type of work that we do.
Yeah.
So the name took, you know, quite a while, you know, 6, 7, 8 months. Cassie and I talking about the name, we want it to be something that represents who we are and the type of work that we do for mob, but also for people who want to work with mob. So the concept or the term of parallax is actually based in astronomy. So it's the parallax effect.
Yeah, right.
And it's the effect of looking at the same thing from two different points of view. And so when we were talking about that definition and thinking about the type of work that we do, that is what we do, bringing the perspectives together of mob that we work with and organisations, and also others who want to work with them.
Yeah. I'll say, just to add from Steph, is I suppose going through for the past 6 months and understanding the meaning behind words, I don't think we've spent so much time using a dictionary or a thesaurus.
That's right.
Trying to understand, like, certain words that we like the meaning of.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually having lunch with a mentor of mine, and we had narrowed it down to like three names that we were really liking. And he was like, oh, you seem frustrated. I'm like, oh, we're tossing up between these three names. And he was like, tell me about what it is that you want to do. And I told him, and he was like, I think this word is still in circulation. And I said to Steph, I didn't know words went out of circulation. So that was one thing that I did learn. And then he just Googles it and he goes, yes, I think this is the word you were after. And I rang her and I said, what do you think about this? And it was just like, it was just perfect. It just described exactly what we wanted, what we were looking for.
Yeah, I liked it straight away, because we often, I say in film or in journalism, I look at things through a black lens.
Yes.
Mm. And I know people I'm doing the story with, the non-Indigenous, will look at it through a different lens.
That's
but
right.
We're looking at the same thing. So it really resonated with me, and I think it's a great name, so well done.
Yeah, thank you. That's good feedback. Thanks for that.
I love learning. I love science. So.
Yes.
Let's talk about your own journeys into getting into the legal profession. And I'll start with you first, Cassie. You said that you wanted to be a lawyer since you were just 9 years of age. I wanted to be a lawyer too when I was little. I was talking before, I used to watch LA Law and things like that with my mum. Shout out, mum. But what hooked you into the legal profession at such a young age?
So my dad actually hurt himself and had to get, went through a situation where he needed a lawyer. And based on the advice and the process from the lawyer, like it didn't actually work out, you know, in his favour, and put us in a pretty difficult situation.
Yeah, right.
And then obviously then becoming aware of what lawyers do, I like to read, so I read a lot, and I was reading like crime novels, and you know, then I thought, oh, I want to be a prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
Although when I was younger, I used to say a prostitutor, which you know, my family loved to remind me of that. You know, even though I'm a lawyer now, I was not so smart back then, and you know, choosing the right words until I realised that meant I would have to work for the police. So then I was like changing my mind. Then I wanted to be those deadly people like on Suits where you get to wear all the fancy suits and do all the big negotiations with the companies. So that's, I've always been interested in solving legal problems, but really about more helping, I suppose, people like my dad understand what their rights are so that they can make a proper informed decision so that, you know, hopefully they don't end up in the same situation that we did.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful thing. I often meet a lot of mob who become something because of a tragedy that happened while they were younger. And for you to do that for your dad, and I just think it's beautiful, sis. I think it's amazing. So.
Well, even when we were doing our website, I would ring him and say, what does this mean to you? And he's like, I don't know what that word means. I'm like, okay, we've got to change that word. So everything I do, even when I'm writing advice, I have him in mind going, how would my dad understand this?
Mm.
Yeah, it's good because, you know, that's a reflection of our mob out there and understanding legalities and all that. So good on you. Steph, what about yourself? I know where you come from, Quandamooka country, big artist community,
yes.
Lots of creatives, and obviously protecting the rights of Aboriginal artists is a big passion of yours. But what drew you into the legal profession, sis?
Yeah, look, I think it really sort of started in my later years of high school, grades 11 and 12, you know, thinking about what I wanted to do. You know, I had thought about being like a teacher or a nurse. I just knew that whatever I wanted to do, it would to be giving back to mob because that was always important to me. You know, growing up in the household, hearing things that mob go through, you know, hearing mum and others talk about what our mob were facing. And so I thought, well, I needed to be able to do something that would give back to try and help the situation of our people. Grade 11 and 12, I did legal studies, and the legal studies teacher actually really, he encouraged me. He planted the seed, you could say.
Yep.
And I always say that he saw something in me at the time that I didn't see, and he encouraged me to go forward and apply to go to QUT to do law and justice. So I always sort of say that that's probably one of the first times that I started thinking about it. It's quite nice, really, because when we launched our the website and on social media a few weeks ago, on the comments, that same teacher commented, my grade 11 and 12 teacher from legal studies. He's like, oh, great. It's so good to see you, Steph, and, you know, open up your new law firm. He's like, geez, it must have been those legal studies that you did, you know, back in grade 11 and 12. So from that point, going to university, learning about the law, and really the skills that it gives you to think critically about things. I think that's one of the biggest things that we got out of the law degree, to analyse situations and apply the law for a particular outcome. As I was going through law school, you know, typically we do think of, you know, criminal law or native title law or family law, which was one of the ways that I thought I could give back most, because that's probably what we're exposed to as most, as mob. But as I went through the law degree, you know, you start learning about commercial law, intellectual property law, and then I moved into, you know, working as a graduate in a law firm that, you know, had an intellectual property section in it. So as part of that law firm, I was doing a whole range of different work for different clients, privacy, franchising, data protection, all types of contracts for a, you know, huge range of companies. because intellectual property is important really to everyone in what they're doing in business as well. So that sort of started on the intellectual property sort of path, mm-hmm. and then also getting to a point where it's like, well, yes, this is really good, but I can also see how these skills and the work that I'm learning here at this law firm can be applied to the work that we need to be done, that needs to be done in our community around protection of art, culture, languages, and all those sorts of things. So that was sort of the journey to get there.
Well, some parts of the legal stuff you're doing just real dry, and you're just like, I'm not doing that. You know what I mean? Like, you try stuff, and it's like in any career, it's, you've got different niches within your career. And, constitutional, all right. You just try stuff and like, that's not for me, I'm going to stick to this area. Yep. Can you talk about that? Because it's really interesting for people to know that you don't have to just do one thing.
Yeah, that's right. And it's good to try as many different areas as possible. And that was probably one of the good pieces of advice that I initially got from a partner at a law firm where I started. I said, I want to come and work with you in the native title area. He said, no, go and work in another area. Go and work in all the other areas that you possibly can. And then let's talk. You know, and then in that time, you know, that's where I found the IP space. And in some ways it was the advice to, you know, not get pigeonholed or not think that that's the only way in which you can give back. You know, understanding the commercial aspects, small businesses, all of the legalities around those setups, agreement making, all of those things that are important to our communities and small businesses, which we are seeing a lot of. And I think for both of us, going through the journey that we've gone through to get here, even if we were doing things at times that weren't really what we wanted to do, it's very important. You got to cut your teeth, you know, and that's what we did. Down on Eagle Street, you know, working in the big commercial firms, we did that. We've done that time. We've learnt how...
skills you up.
Absolutely. And you have to do that for us to be in the position now where we can do things our way.
I suppose I have a similar story. So I also did a cadetship, but I did mine at another big firm. And like I said, I wanted to be the fancy lawyer working with the big corporates, doing all of those big deals. But I started in banking and finance, and that was the first rotation, and I didn't have a choice. That's where they put me.
Yeah, right.
I had a vacancy there. But as I started, it was the GFC hit. So they were downsizing. The deals for banking and finance weren't happening. And the partner, the HR said, you know, we've got to rotate you because there's no work here. And they said, we're going to put you in native title. I'm like, oh, I hated native title at university. I don't want to do this. Like, I hated that subject. Anyway, I met the lady who had just started with the firm, and her and I hit it off.
And
I was like, oh, she's pretty fun. Like, maybe she could make this subject, which I really did not like, really entertaining. And
why didn't you like native title?
Oh, I suppose... because the way that it was taught at university was a very specific part of it, and it's actually not even relevant.
And I guess it was through a white lens.
Yeah, through a white lens, but also it's not even applicable to what I was actually doing in practice. Like, it's stuff that you would probably, now that the compensation stuff is coming in, that you would actually be using. But I was like, not relevant at all, very dry. And what I liked about it is that she would take me out and I got to meet people. So I was out in community, I was working with groups, and I'm a people person. So I did that with her for probably about 12 months, and then an opportunity came because I was a grad, I had to rotate out. So then I got to rotate into the corporate team, which is the team I was like, that was my team. Like, that was the dealer makers, you know, setting up the companies and doing all of that. That's where I wanted to be, and I got there and I hated it. It was so boring because all I did was sit behind a desk, type, do data entry, like review agreements.
And you're like, I want to talk to people.
Yeah, I'm like, I need to talk to people. And then I was always getting in trouble because I was walking around the office having conversations with everybody in the team, and they're like, you need to get back to your desk and do this
stuff.
Hey,
get back and do that data entry, sis. What are you doing?
And I'm like, oh, this is not for me. So then after a while, I was like, can I go back? Because I can't do this where I'm not talking to, you know, I'm not getting context. I wasn't getting context. So it was just here. This is the very specific task. And I couldn't do it because my brain doesn't work like that, because I didn't understand the whole picture of what they were trying to do. So I couldn't, I really struggled. And then you got to go back to Native Title, and I have been there for the last, you know, 14 years.
Unreal. Talk about coming full circle with it. You know? Well, you have a sip of water there, sis. Sorry.
No, all good.
Okay, let's get into the chats now around what yous do. Let's start with Native Title. It's such a... I've been a journo over 20 years. I still really don't know what it is. It's, you know, some days you think I do, but then it seems to be such a convoluted mess sometimes. Can you tell us what is Native Title? No pressure.
I can tell you what it's not.
Yeah. And tell us what... Let's go to the... What are the misconceptions around Native Title?
Yeah, I suppose, and it's a good topic to touch on given, you know...
Because some of us think, oh, that's a treaty.
Yeah.
It's not.
It's not, and it's not land rights either.
Not land rights.
No. And I think a lot of this topic will be discussed, hopefully, a lot in the coming, you know, coming weeks, given we're leading up to 30 years of Mabo on the 3rd of June.
Yep.
So it's probably a really good time just to revisit. And as we get more and more determinations of Native Title across Australia, I think it'll be... It's going to be interesting to see how, you know, community actually try and use their Native Title rights. So depending on, again, it's very complicated. There's nothing in Native Title that is straightforward and easy, unfortunately. It's a very complicated piece of legislation. But at its basics, the Native Title Act sets out a framework that provides for the first step is basically the recognition process. And that's really what it is. It's a recognition of rights and interests of the people who have the best evidence that they can prove that they were there at the point of first contact. So it's not necessarily about proving the right people for country.
Mm-hmm.
It's people who have the best evidence to show that they were there at the point of first contact and that they have a set of laws and customs that basically describe a society and they have continued to practice that from point of contact right up until today. So that often means that there are people who maybe missed out because they don't have their ancestors aren't documented in, you know,
because, you know,
history.
Genocide.
Yeah.
Genocide, yes. Yep. So it's one of the biggest misconceptions is it about right people for place. It's not.
Yep, all right.
It's based on those who have the best evidence. And obviously the threshold is ridiculously high.
Very high.
Very high, which makes
What does that mean?
So it means that you've got this level you've got to meet in relation to evidence.
Yeah.
And if you don't meet it, and the state and the Commonwealth have to be happy that the amount of evidence that you're showing to demonstrate this, which again, they have all of their research and history because, you know, most of their pastoralists wrote it all, makes it really hard. You know, you're arguing against the state and Commonwealth about continuation of laws and customs.
Yeah.
In some parts of Australia, it's that evidence is a lot stronger and they've got records, and other parts it's not as well kept. So, you know, you've got this various levels.
Mm.
And then within that, you have it then gets more complicated because you have different levels. So you have non-exclusive Native Title rights and interests, and then you have exclusive Native Title rights and interests, and they vary across the country as well. Mm. And then the other thing, the Act, so you get your recognition. So once you've been recognised and acknowledged as being whoever those group of people were at the point of first contact, that you can say you come down from them. You then have a set of what you would call rights and interests, and they might be like the right to hunt, the right to conduct ceremony, the right to protect sacred sites, the right to access and camp. So you have like various levels of rights that are agreed to that you can continue to use certain areas within your determination area for one or claim area for a better description.
Mm-hmm.
But normally you have to have an agreement with, say, the pastoral holder to go and use and access that part of land to go and continue to conduct ceremony or hunt or whatever it is that you wanted to do. So that's part of the recognition process.
Yeah, right.
Then you have a process that goes on to say, once you have, you know, anybody who then wants to do some sort of work or activity on a piece of land that there is either a Native Title claim or a determination over it, there is a process that the Native Title Act sets out that you have to follow. So there is a process of which how they identify who they need to talk to and then what rights basically as a Native Title group have in relation to responding, negotiating, objecting to that type of activity. And again, that is complicated.
Mm. Yeah, it almost sounds, you know, sorry to be so cynical, but it sounds like this is a system that was set up to make us fail. because it's so hard to prove. And, you know, native title causes so many fights between mob. Mm. I've seen it firsthand with my mob, and, you know, we're going through Santos stuff at the moment, and I see it across the nations, you know, with native title applicants, and it's often pits one family against another. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes you have a third entity, such as a mining company or whatever, come in and, you know, conquer and divide even further. But, yeah, this sounds so challenging, the system.
It's very challenging.
Do we get wins from it that you've seen firsthand from a lawyer? Can you tell us?
So I suppose once you've had your rights recognised and you've got your determination, so that you set up your a corporation, and it's in native title land, we call it a PBC, which is a prescribed body corporate. And that then entity has, you know, it has a little bit of leverage. And then you can't, if you were to rely just directly on the native title, like you probably wouldn't get very far. Mm-hmm. So it's about trying to be creative and problem solve, and using the opportunity to sit at the table to have conversations. That's the leverage. And then it's around, well, how creative can you be and how willing the other side of the negotiations are in relation to negotiating, like, you know, some sort of outcome. Mm. And if you've got, and, you know, there are so many, I suppose, energy companies, renewables that are now coming into our space that are actually are funded from overseas, so you can actually hook into their reporting and obligations in relation to free, prior and informed consent, how they engage with the First Nations people of their country based on where they're getting their funding from.
Yep.
So you can actually go and use international declarations and
standards. So you can go to the UN.
Not necessarily the UN, but so you've got the International Finance Committee from the World Bank, which funds a lot of stuff. So there are a lot of superannuation funds from over in Europe that are now investing in renewable energy projects in Australia.
Yeah, right.
And they're all subject to other various international instruments. So if you're creative, you can then go and rely on them and be saying, well, please tell us how you're meeting X, Y, and Z, because if, you know, this, we don't think this agreement is at that level. And then, you know, there are options where you can report that to, you know, that international committee or funding body and to hold them account.
Wow. Mind boggles.
Yeah.
The mind boggles. And how does this work with cultural heritage? Like, I remember, so for me, I lived up in Kakadu for a number of years, and one of the things up there was I was really hooked into cultural heritage because we're using cultural heritage to protect landmarks from mining companies. So we'd arm ourselves with as much cultural heritage as we could and get that registered and go through processes to get that all protected, because that would stop mining companies from coming into Kakadu and ripping up the land.
Yep.
But how does cultural heritage and native title work in together?
Well, it's really interesting.
Or is it different?
No, well, if you were to talk to, say, most lawyers and most lawyers that I negotiate against, it's they're separate, but I'm like, they're not.
They're not.
They're not, because you
and
can't...
That's the parallax of it.
Yeah, because you can't have...
See what I did there?
I liked it.
Yep,
so
very good.
Their rights, so the things you get, your rights and interests are recognised that you have a society that is based on laws and customs. Those laws and customs would set out and say how, you know, you might have dreaming sites, sacred areas where you used to hunt. There might be stories connected to all of that. That's cultural heritage, but that's also your native title rights. So they're actually intertwined. But protected under different pieces of legislation. That's really the difference. So Native Title Act is a Commonwealth piece of legislation.
Yep.
In Queensland, we have the Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Act and the Torres Strait Islander Cultural Heritage Act. So they're both Queensland pieces of legislation. And they've actually are both just gone through, they're going through a review, and the government had just recently asked, put out an options paper and encouraged people to, I suppose, put in an answer and a series of questions to help them think about how they're going to redesign, I'm hoping, the Act, because a lot of the things the Act does not cover is that intangible elements of cultural heritage. And this is the part where what I do and what Steph does actually really comes together nicely.
Yep.
So, you know, being able to put in place protections, because when you're talking about cultural heritage and we're talking about artifacts and we're talking about fish traps and we're talking about, you know, a quarry, or we're talking about grinding grooves, they can see that stuff. They get it. You know, energy companies, mining companies, they understand that that is something that is important.
Yep.
The part they can't understand is that intangible stuff, you know, where there is storylines or there is...
Like a song line.
Song right. line, yep.
Why all those of, artifacts actually exist.
Yep.
Yep. And so
why
if they can't see it, they can't believe it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And that's those lenses we were talking about before, yep. Danny, you know, looking at things differently. And I think that's, again, it comes back to the type of work that we're doing, being able to have a seat at the table on behalf of our clients and making sure that that lens and that perspective is also being taken into account in all of these commercial matters.
Yeah, it's such great work you just do, because it must be fascinating conversations when you're at the table with these other mob and you're trying to explain this sort of thing. And I guess you're trying to give them an understanding of what it is, right? Because they can't see it, they won't believe it. So you're trying to paint a picture for them to get it. So it must be fascinating dynamics at those tables. Mm.
It is, and it's a constant sort of education process that we go through as well, not only like with our clients on the journey that they're on, but also with others on the other side and those who want to work with mob. You know, they've got a lot of learning to do as well. And, you know, the type of clients and work that we want to be doing, we want to be working with people who want to do the work too.
Yeah.
You know, we're with you on this journey.
Yep.
And, you know, you've got to be prepared to put in the hard yards.
And have the hard conversations.
Yes.
Because, like, none of the stuff we do involves an easy conversation. There's always an element of history that we have to address. Yep. Like, there's, you know, when we're talking
the uncomfortable truths.
The uncomfortable truths.
Absolutely.
And it gets awkward and uncomfortable. And, you know, when I'm engaging, and Steph and I talk about this a lot, like, when we're meeting with, you know, either proponents or new clients who want to work with community, we say, you know, you have to be prepared to get awkward and uncomfortable, because there are going to be some truths that maybe you haven't been ready to hear or talk about, but particularly in my space, we can't avoid it.
Yeah.
Like, we can't avoid, if I'm talking about, you know, the continuation of a society and your ability to exercise your rights and interests, we're going to talk about, well, who come on and what happened to the land, how it was used, what happened to the people who lived there.
Mm.
And there are some uncomfortable stories that people don't necessarily always want to talk about.
Has there been a big shift in cultural heritage and the way that we sort of look at it, a native title, after what happened in Juukan Gorge? For you as a black lawyer, has it been a monumental shift? Because that was crazy what they did.
I'd say there's not a monumental shift, but there has been a slow shift.
Yeah.
In Queensland, there has been a shift probably over the last couple of years. So before Juukan Gorge, there was already this slow shift starting to happen where proponents, and I think it was because of a lot of the international influence was coming in from, like I said, those international funding bodies. So
yep.
They were actually having to report to a higher standard already. So they were already there. What was previously considered best practice was actually getting lifted a level. And then after Juukan Gorge, it's just lifted, you know,
yeah,
a little bit more. But it's we're definitely having slightly different conversations. There is more of a willingness, I suppose, for, you know, because in the past it would have been, you know, our group would say, here, this is where our cultural heritage is, this is how we want to manage it. And they would go, oh, yeah, okay, you know, rubber stamp, thanks very much, and then just do what they wanted anyway.
Yeah.
And then when you try and put in a damage or, a breach notice with the cultural heritage unit, nothing really got done. That's changed. So the minute they think something might have been wrong, like, it stopped work, let's have a conversation, let's go back and investigate, where was, like, what happened? Like, so there is, I suppose, a much more readiness of them to pull up stumps.
Yep.
Mm.
And then have a conversation with them before.
Mm.
No, that's really good to hear. Any shift is a good shift, because we can't, once the site's gone, it's gone forever. Yeah. Steph, let's shift over to you now with some of your work.
Yes.
Particularly around the Indigenous Art Code. And so can you tell us, I guess, your main field and what you do around sort of the protection of art and artists and defending their rights?
Yes. So a lot of the work that I do is in the intellectual property and general commercial space. So that is around the protection of those intangible rights that Cassie was talking about. That's important for mob, of course, but also for, you know, non-Indigenous artists and people and the development of their businesses and work that they do. So I deal with things like copyright and licensing agreements. So if somebody wants to reproduce an artwork, you know, you see all these amazing collaborations with artists and fashion lines and
there's so much more of it these days, right?
Yeah, homeware lines. Yep. I mean, it's exploding.
Adairs.
Yes, all of that.
Yep.
I can't afford it, but anyway.
Spotlight is having a sale and they got some stuff there.
Are they? 50% off. Get down there.
So a lot of the work is around those types of agreements and, again, engagement and protocol. yes, we can do the legal agreements, mm-hmm. just like any other lawyer can, but what does your engagement process and protocol look like? How are you making sure that when you engage with artists or with mob, you're doing that in a way that respects not only the physical art piece, mm-hmm. but also the intangible rights and knowledge that sit behind that work? So that's a big focus of the work that we're doing at Parallax Legal. I wear a few other different hats as well. So I am the chairperson of the Indigenous Art Code. Mm-hmm. So it's a national voluntary code of conduct. It was set up in 2010, and it really came out of an inquiry that at that time looked at the exploitation of artists and looking at the issues that were happening with artists. And one of the recommendations from that inquiry was the establishment of the Indigenous Art Code. Mm-hmm. So that's how it was set up. We have a board that has a broad range of people from the industry, representatives of independent artists, art centres, other industry bodies, and also board-appointed people, so lawyers, accountants, broad range of people. The Indigenous Art Code has a membership, so we're membership-based, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artists can sign up to be members of the Indigenous Art Code. That's free. It doesn't cost anything. And what that process is really doing as an artist is contributing to, the message and the positioning of artists getting a fair go in their deals.
Because they have been ripped off for years. And I've seen firsthand, like, mob get ripped off. Yes. And it's shocking, you know. Yeah. Like, that's our culture. That's our story.
Right. Yes.
You know, and it gets ripped.
We also have dealer members. So these are dealers who engage in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artworks. They either sell it mm-hmm. or they license it. So a lot of that reproduction work as well. And these are dealers that have come to us to sign up. We've gone through the processes of understanding how they operate and do business with artists mm-hmm. and they become members. So people can look up on the Indigenous Art Code website, you know, what dealers are members of the Indigenous Art Code. It just means that they have demonstrated to us at the Code that they're committed to ethical practice and transparency in dealing with artists. Not every dealer is a member of the Indigenous Art Code, and just because they're not a member doesn't mean they're doing the wrong thing. It just means that at the Code we haven't had visibility over what their processes are.
Yep.
So, again, it's a constant education process as well of understanding what is good practice. And I think one of the key things at the Code is ensuring supporting dealer members to do the right thing, because there are dealers who want to know how to do things better and to be there to support them to get there. And then also ensuring that artists, in whatever arrangement they're entering into, they've got all the information before them that they need to make a proper informed decision. They're exercising their agency.
That'd be harder as an artist because you're so focused on your work and your creativity.
Yes.
And then you have to do it. You know, you have to get this whole business and legal side understanding sorted as well, right?
Yes, that's right.
And that's hard.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's hard to understand.
Yes, it is. And I think when there's, you know, those types of advocacy groups around and like Arts Law Centre of Australia as well, Artists in the Black, you know, these are organisations that can help artists through these processes. So, again, it's continuous work. It's good work. And the Indigenous Art Code, you know, we've also been involved in all the stuff around the fake art campaign, which has obviously been massive.
That was huge.
Yeah, huge. And it's still ongoing.
Yeah.
There was a big process that came out of that fake art harms culture campaign, and it was artist-led, which is very important for people to know, is that, you know, artists were coming to organisations like the Code, Copyright Agency, Arts Law, saying, we're seeing all this stuff in the shops, you know, but we know that doesn't look right.
I went undercover in shops in Sydney.
Oh, did you?
When I was down with NITV and whatnot. Yeah. And we did a whole, like, fake art campaign. And it was just the amount of fake art in all the stores down there, just in Circular Quay, for example. But I also remember the story. I think it was Bibi Baba. And it was a motel chain in Sweden or somewhere.
Poland,
that's right. Yeah. So they ripped off her artwork off the canvas and printed it on the carpet. So all the carpets were her artwork.
That's right.
And so that whole story, when something like that happens, how do you hold people to account and get the artists their rights and I guess get them compensated for their work?
Yeah, in a situation like that involving like overseas.
International stuff, right?
That's very difficult. You have to institute proceedings over there as well. And, you know, different copyright laws, you know, probably laws that wouldn't, you know, have the same type of recognition or understanding of, you know, Indigenous cultural intellectual property rights and what that means. So when there's an overseas layer added to it, that can be quite complex. Here in Australia, when there are questions of copyright infringement, you know, there's processes that you can go through, putting people on notice, letters of demand, you know, the negotiation back and forth as to what the infringement might be, whether there's a conceding or not, or, you know, what happens, is it a takedown, is it an apology, is it compensation? Yep. So there's all these things that can be wrapped up in that type of infringement process.
Yeah, I remember being John Paul Jenke, mate of mine, he went over to Bali and he went in and just saw the mob there and they're doing all the fake dots on all the stuff, and you see all the fake didgeridoos that are sold everywhere and whatnot, and I sort of understand it over there, but they're very, you know, those people are really in poverty. They don't know what, you know, we're offending the Aboriginal mob. I don't think they really think about that if they've got to put food on the table. So it's complex.
It is complex, and I think you're right, there's that exploitation of that mob over there too because of what they're in and what... the fake art, what's really important is to know that it's non-Indigenous businesses doing the importation.
Yeah.
So there's exploitation over there, importing it here, and the exploitation that goes on here. So these are Australian businesses who are doing that. And currently there's no law stopping them from doing that. All they have to make sure is that it's not misleading. Mm. So if something is imported and it has been, you know, created over there in Bali, .style on a painting or whatnot, imported here and sold.
The goannas look like geckos, by the way.
There you go. as long as it's very clear that it's not being presented or represented as Aboriginal art, it's fine. It sits within this really strange area of the law. And again, all of the work that's come out of the campaign is about trying to push forward reform and change in those areas. So,
And education.
Mm. So some of the legal amendments that we will put up was amendments to the Australian Consumer Law, which is where that misleading and deceptive conduct sort of area sits. Those amendments, unfortunately, they were looked at, but they haven't been pushed through. You know, we can put the amendments up, but there's a political aspect to it as well. What's the appetite to get it through? So that's another level to deal with. And then at the same time, which has also been spoken about for many years and by many people, is our own standalone legislation dealing with Indigenous cultural and intellectual property rights. That conversation's been going on for a long time and will continue to do so.
No. It's you can feel the passion come out of both of you when you're yarning about your work.
Yeah. I feel it too.
You're getting pumped up.
Yeah.
I might become a lawyer. It's not too late. Right?
You can do it.
Live out my childhood dream. Yeah. Look out. Let's talk about the Black Indigenous lawyer landscape. Who's out there? Who's doing what? You guys are just the tip of the iceberg, it seems, of amazing mob out there doing amazing work that we know nothing about. And that's one of the things I want to do on Let's Talk, is create a space for our Black lawyers to come in and share their work and what they're doing. Because our community needs to know. There's so much like cool stuff going on out there. Mm. Often we get lost in the negative news cycle sometimes in media. So to be able to talk about all the great things that yous are doing out there. So fill us in. Who's some of the lawyers out there doing some great things? Tell us about the Indigenous lawyer networks that we can tap into. And then I'll follow up after that.
Oh, I suppose, well, we've got the Indigenous Lawyers of Association of Queensland, which I'm currently vice president of, and that's the peak body of legal professionals and also people who work in the legal space. So we have a number of, who not necessarily have got a law degree but decided for whatever reason not to practice or practice for a little bit and have then gone and explored other avenues. There is a lot more now than when I think you and I both went through, Steph. It's definitely grown a lot.
Yes.
But obviously we've got Joss Kramer, barrister, doing a lot of the work in the stolen wages space.
Mm-hmm.
He's very active on social media and he's LinkedIn.
So the stolen wages stuff's still ongoing? Yeah, right.
So he's doing the stuff in the Northern Territory and I think WA at the moment.
Yeah, right.
I see them travelling around at the moment. Yeah,
he's doing a lot of consultations. And with him he's got Annie O'Reilly. She's at Shine, so she's working with him. And I think he's got a junior barrister, Malia Ben, who I think she got admitted called to the bar same time as Abby. So then you've got Avelina, who's also another barrister.
Avelina Tarago.
She does a lot of work with the Coroner's Court, the Health Ombudsman. She does some work in the fraud and compliance space. She does some really interesting work. She was our previous president of the Indigenous Lawyers Association. Then we've got Candice. Oh, what's Candice's last name? Candice. I'm going to get a message from her later saying, how did you forget my last name? Candice, who is doing a lot of work in the youth justice space down at
Logan.
We've got Kristen Hodge, who is also in the native title space, working at Queensland South Native Title Services. We've got Ivan Ingram, who was the first Indigenous judicial registrar in the federal court.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Wyatt Cook Revel,
yes,
who is now a graduate at Ashurst.
Trent Wallace is also at Ashurst.
I wonder how many black lawyers we have across the country.
Oh, there's stats on that.
Are we up into the hundreds yet?
Yeah, there are stats.
Yeah.
I think we're in Queensland. I'm pretty sure we're just at or just over the 100.
That's unreal.
Mm. And it's, again, trying to find a way to collect
all that data.
Yeah.
So that we can tap into that network.
Yeah, because I don't think our community knows just how big our black legal network is.
There's Donnell Mills, who's now at King and Wild Mallison's,
yes,
in their pro bono space. Mm-hmm. Like, she's head of or senior associate in pro bono. I think we find more and more,
yes,
of them when you go to different events.
Because my intersection with lawyers has always been the Aboriginal Legal Service, and that's,
yep,
about it, right?
Yep.
And beyond that, I don't know too much what's going on. So this has been really refreshing to hear that. Just outside of the criminal system, there's just so much going on with our lawyers. And
there is.
I interviewed Tony McAvoy a fair,
yes,
bit.
Yes.
I let him go for half an hour, and then I say, okay, can you tell me that in 2 minutes in English? Because he's brain and he's a silk, right?
Yeah.
And his understanding of, you know, his passion is treaties. I talk to him a lot about the treaties and the treaty process here in Australia. And it's just, he does fascinating work around that as well.
Absolutely. And I think what's, you know, important for everyone to know is that there's so many different ways to be a lawyer,
mm,
and so many different areas, whether you're doing your straight up and down legal work, engagement work, supporting, you know, law students, working in community legal centre, you know, working down on Eagle Street, opening up your own law firm, mm, as lawyers.
Yes.
So there's so many different ways to do law.
Yeah.
And to be a lawyer, and I think
being a government in-house,
government
lawyer, being in-house for
a big company,
there's so many.
And the benefit of that is not only improving the profession for all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students and lawyers coming through, but also the benefit that we give and value that we give as black lawyers to the organisations, mm, that we're working in,
mm,
and bringing that different perspective in and making sure that those conversations are being had, making sure that those perspectives are being acknowledged and heard and understood.
If there's some young sisters and brothers at uni now, they're doing law and they're struggling a bit and thinking about, my change, this is getting a bit much, because it is, you just have to read and read and read and read. I was even getting sick of journalism doing that. But, you know, what advice will you give them to sort of keep them staying in there? Because no doubt you would have had times where you're going, oh, geez, this is getting a bit difficult.
Yeah.
But as we sort of start to wind it up, because we want to see another army of black lawyers come through the ranks, right, and you know, really hook in there and advocate for our mob on any level. So what do you tell them?
Well, I would tell them to, you know, stick it out. Mm. You know, I know it seems hard right now and at that time that you're probably going through. There will be others in your same situation thinking the same thing. If you do have Indigenous units at your university, so at QUT where we went through, there was the Ujuru unit,
mm-hmm,
and then also specific people within our law faculties that supported, mm, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, students coming through. So I would say to connect into those units and support systems and other students. I look back at university and think it was, you know, while it was hard at the time, it was one of the best, it was the best time. I loved it, enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Great years,
yeah,
you know. Going to uni games. Make sure you go to uni games because you get to meet other black students from all over the country.
And you get mad tracksuits.
Yeah, that's it. All cruise around together. So good. So good. I would just say, like, you know, reach out for others and try and find your support network. And if you can, you know, get home if you can as well too, because it's important to connect back with your own mob if you're able.
Yeah.
Honestly, I definitely think the units so Steph and I met at QUT through the unit. And I think I went through with Avelina, so at the unit. And, you know, those networks that you make, like, they continue to support you after you leave law school. Like, that's, I think, is a really important point. But also, I don't actually remember anything I was taught at law school except for maybe a bit of research and maybe...
You learn it once you get in the real world.
Read maybe some legislation and find it. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you anything else that I learned or that I remember to use. Because obviously they give you a broad at university. It's just the very basics, the foundations. And then depending on what area you end up practicing in, some of it's completely irrelevant. Like, I suppose it's like high school. I don't remember anything I learned at high school either. But obviously it teaches you something because you then continue to build on it. Mm. So I'd say don't get too bogged down in the fact that if you're finding it boring or hard, look at the skills, because I think the skills, like you, Steph, touched on earlier, the skills that we have in relation to being able to break issues and problems down, identify possible solutions and how to navigate that legal landscape, like, that's critical. Whether or not you then choose to use those skills in practice, that's a totally different decision. But the skills that you get in law school can take you to do anything. You could become, you know, work your way up to become a CEO. You know, you could work your way in governance space. Mm-hmm. Like, there's the skills that you learn are actually really important, I think, very versatile.
Mm. Yeah, deadly. Sisters, just lastly, if mob want to engage with you ladies through Parallax, where do they find you, mob?
Yep, so we've got our website, parallaxlegal.com.au, and there's a little contact us page there. So if mob want to get in touch, you can put your details in there, send a message through that way. We're also on Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn as Parallax Legal. So you can also engage with us through our social media platforms as well. And the idea that you'll be seeing, you know, more topics and things that we're working on and interested in also coming out through those platforms as well. So we also hope that people following us can also, you know, be, you know, understand the work that we're doing and also, you know,
get some education out of it,
exactly, at the same time.
No, good on you. I think it's amazing and inspiring what you both do. And thanks for coming in and explaining your work today and, you know, trying to drop some knowledge on native title and Indigenous art code and IP and copyright, all this sort of stuff. So,
can I just say, before we wrap up, because the amount of, like, support and love that we've been getting from mob, like, all over, you know, yes, this is us doing what we're doing at Parallax Legal, but the amount of support that we've been getting from everyone who's been with us along the way and even new people now, like, I just want to say that, you know, we see it all and we love it all and, you know, and it's just really good feeling for us having mob behind us at this stage, and we know that, you know, mob know us too. Yep. This is in Brizzy.
Yeah.
And so we thank everyone for all of that love. We see it and it's really good for us in our, you know, next step as we move forward.
I suppose it probably gives us a bit of strength and comfort to you know, that we can do this because we're not actually, it doesn't feel like we're doing this by ourselves.
It gives us strength seeing you sisters do what you do too.
But it doesn't feel like we're doing it by ourselves. It definitely feels like we've got, you know, we've got so many supporters.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a great way to go out on a Friday yarn, eh?
Deadly.
Black Excellence Friday. Well, Parallax Legal are Black Excellence. Thank you, sisters, for coming in. And remember, if you're in Maruka or Quandamooka, you're listening to AAA Murray Country.